Good afternoon. We're going to open up the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. We're going to be opening up our public hearing on Senate Bill 5501, the Oregon Board of Accountancy, the Budget Appropriation Bill. What do we need to know first?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, member of the committee.
That's the two of us.
There's not much we need to know about the committee, except it's all other funded. And with you here today is Martin Pattoni, the executive director of the board, and Larry Brown, the board chair. And they will present to you their agency overview. And then Mark Medina from DAS will present the governor.
Perfect. So gentlemen, why don't you come on up? And I think we have you for one day. One day, so we have 1 hour and 25 minutes to get through the full show. So, and we're going to have public testimony. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to keep us moving right along. If you could help me with that,
Yes,
sounds good to me.
All right, so I'm going to turn this over to you.
Okay, Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pattoni. I'm the executive director for the Board of Accountancy. And with me today, to my left, is Larry Brown, who is the board chair of the Board of Accountancy. We're actually very delighted to help you out with that timeline, because we were told we would have somewhere around 20 to 30 minutes for this. So we're actually prepared to go through this pretty quickly. And we'll split that between Larry and I. And basically, we have about 10 slides we want to run through with you. And I'll just make sure that I move this along here a little bit and start with a high-level overview. And just in general, what I'd like to accomplish here today is, in those 10 slides, what we're really going to try to do is give you a high-level overview over what we do, covering our successes and our challenges, and how those challenges feed into the responses that we were either able to accomplish on our own, or responses that we're asking for help with that tie into the 1517 request for the agency. So very briefly, our mission is to protect the public by regulating the practice and performance of the services provided by our licensees. The board's been around for a little over 100 years. We currently license about 8,000 individuals and 1,000 firms, and we have a generally very stable licensing base. We have 7 board members, governor appointed and Senate confirmed, and a staff of currently 8, which includes a limited duration position. So the permanent funding base is on 7. Currently, we have 8, and we're requesting the 8th position as one of the policy packages, and we'll get into that in a moment. The total request size for the governor's budget for the agency is $2.469 million, which is about 7.2% above the legislatively approved budget for the current biennium. That is if you include, as I was asked to do to be consistent with other presentations, the e-board-related actions from the biennium. We originally started out with a $2.104 million appropriation. Expenditure limitation for the agency for 13-15, and then by e-board action last September, another $200,000 was added.
Help me understand
that
really quick. I want to make sure I visualize this correctly. Are the fee, the application fee, is that an annual fee, or do you pay as you become licensed? What I'm trying to do is determine cash flow. Does all your money come in at one block, or does it come in spread out over a biennium?
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, the answer is that only a small portion of our revenue is regular. That is primarily exam applicants and initial applicants. The primary revenue driver for the agency are annual individual licensure renewals.
And those come in any time during the calendar?
And they can, and they only come in June and July.
Okay, so you have a peak.
We have a peak. Big time peak, yes. Okay. And so there are two-year licenses, and half of our licensee base renews every year. So we still have a two-year license structure, but every year half the licensee base renews.
Perfect. Didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to
visualize that. No, that's a great question.
Well, if I may, and I'll introduce myself later. That's individual licensees. Smoothing out that peak a tiny bit is that firm registrations come in at the end of a calendar year.
At the end of the calendar.
Yeah. But we still have a very significant spike in the May, June, July timeframe.
Okay, let me ask one more question. Your typical ending fund balance, what's that running? Is it, where are you at right now?
Well, Coach Smith, I'll give you a couple of numbers. I don't know how to define the word typical necessarily. It has been usually around $1.4, $1.5 million. Okay. But one of the issues we're going to get into as part of these slides is that we have now entered a period of falling ending balances, and we'll get into why.
Okay,
but historically, if typical equals historically, that's where it used to be. But that's not where we're going to end up this biennium. I think it's going to be a lot closer to a mill.
Okay.
And with further downward trend next biennium, and we'll get into that for the reasons why in a moment.
Okay, I'll hold tight.
In terms of the other overview that I have included in that budget request are two policy packages focused on compliance, and Larry will get into those a little bit later, and just at least a brief high level mention on our performance measures. In general, we're doing relatively well. Where we are struggling is basically the same area where we struggled last time, which is timely resolution of complaints. There is some progress that I'll get into in a little bit on where we are making progress and why. But that's the very high-level summary of where we're at on our performance measures. Now, if I go to the next slide, you'll have, you know, a little bit less talk and more graphic. That makes this hopefully a little bit clearer just in terms of the size of what we're dealing with. So the first bar is the current legislatively approved budget for the current biennium. Again, that's including the $200,000 e-board action. And then that's about a 7.2% differential to what is proposed. If you take out the e-board action and use the other number as a base, which is the 2.104, it will be about a 17% increase. So that tells you a little bit right there. And then the middle bar shows you that our actual current service level budget is $2.1 million for this biennium, which is obviously quite a jump, because it means that the CSL level is about roughly the level where the original LAB was at, even though it has one position less, and we'll get into the reasons for why that is down the road. So what I'd like to do in the remaining portion of my presentation, and I'm trying very hard not to reveal that the chair and I have a bet on how long I will talk, is that I would like to, in the remaining two slides, really focus on a little bit of a promise kept conversation with the committee, and that's around, you know, you may recall that for those of you who were here in the last session, mm-hmm. that one of the promises that I very much put on the record during our hearing is that we would be approaching our efficiency in our IT pieces very differently than the stories that you heard last time around. And the promise that I made on the record last time is that we would move toward small, incremental management of IT pieces that would be within budget and, quite frankly, manageable for the agency. And that is something that, fortunately, I can report to the committee today, we very much delivered on. So what that means is, in the bullet points that are covered here, first focus on transparency and efficiency improvement was upgrading of our web lookup for our consumers. So we improved not just the look and feel, we also added disciplinary data very explicitly. We added web publication of our disciplinary action summaries on the front page in both historical and alphabetical versions, because there's lots of different customers and lots of different needs for that. That is used both by consumers who are looking up a particular licensee and may want to find out why is it that that person has a disciplinary mark on their lookup and want to find out a little bit more detail they can without contacting the board. The other piece that's important here, so this is also a very significant tool for our licensees and the people that instruct ethics for our licensees, because they see, okay, here's what the board's paying attention to, and here's what results in disciplinary action, and they use it as a teaching tool in their classes, which is, quite frankly, a best-case scenario, because you get into preventative pieces that help you hopefully hold down future complaints if you get that information out there. The other piece that we were able to accomplish is that we've been able to improve significantly the transparency with other jurisdictions. So when I came on board back in 2012, middle of 2012, there really was no linkage of our data to our other jurisdictions. And actually, for the accountancy profession, that's pretty unusual, because actually most boards were already connected to a national database. This is a very mobile profession. There's lots of people who want to get nationally based data. So one of the things that we accomplished here during this biennium is that we linked all of our licensing and disciplinary data through an automatic uplink to the National Association of State Board of Accountancy's databases. And that was fully completed. It was actually done very innovatively, because we were able to do a three-party memorandum of understanding where we actually didn't have to pay out of our budget a dime. We would be simply a party to the project.
What are the most likely reasons for disciplinary action?
Larry, do you want to take that one, since that's more of a...
I'm not looking for personal example either, yeah, or individual examples, but in general.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the questions?
In general, what's the top disciplinary action, cause of disciplinary action?
Not taking enough deductions.
Not taking... what's the primary cause of a disciplinary action?
Co-chair Representative Smith and the committee, I will get into that in a little more detail.
Okay.
I would say, unfortunately, in the past year or two, the most frequent is administrative in nature. Person didn't take enough of the CPE, so their license lapsed, and
okay,
they need to get back in good standing.
Okay.
Having said that, it's not a trivial issue, because we find that a significant disproportionate number of complaints comes from people who have their license lapsed, so there might be a cause-effect issue there. To me, probably the most troubling is the issues with respect to professional misconduct, and in the last few years, it seems like we've had a significant increase in complaints and investigations with respect to, for lack of a better term, ethical behavior.
Just not being honest in the work.
Business transactions with clients without full disclosure, providing investment advice when you're not really trained and licensed to do so, representing two sides to a divorce situation.
That makes sense.
You represented the husband and wife for years, and so now they're divorced. They have conflicting interests. And you say, oh, sure, I can help you both, but inevitably, that creates a problem. You can only serve one master. So unfortunately, we've seen a rise in ethical issues especially in terms of the nature, complexity, time-consuming investigations.
Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt, but thank you.
Oh, that's fine. So very briefly, just to finish up kind of what we've been able to accomplish kind of on the transparency and efficiency in the IT end, the other piece that, beyond linking us to that national database, which is also quite frankly a consumer deal, because there's a consumer website called cpaverify.org where they get access to national level data. We also made some other small IT improvements that will help us internally that are less external. And most of that has to do with elimination of dual manual entry processes. So, for example, what that deals with is we completed a project that eliminates dual entry of the exam applicants that come in the door to us. They had to be entered into our database and then hand-entered into the national database. We eliminated that piece, and that is now done on an automatic upload basis. We're still working on the reverse end of that project, because we're also trying to automate the downloads from that database into ours, which will also help us eliminate manual entry. So bottom line is, we kept the promise of small, incremental, under budget IT pieces where we can say the project is done, it's not just a promise, and it's completed. The other piece, quite frankly, that just came together yesterday, finally, is that as of yesterday, the board is up on Twitter and Facebook, so we're also trying to make other improvements in terms of how we communicate with our licensees and our demographics that will help us down the road. Now, finally, on the last slide that I get to cover, I want to give you a little bit of an overview of how we're dealing with the primary challenge, and I'll stay a little bit more on the data side of the equation. And I will ask then the board chair to take over, because the board chair is really the one who's lived and breathed far longer than I have. Really the in-depth.
That didn't sound well.
Try that again.
Yeah, please. I'm not that much older.
Yeah. Well, talking about his exposure to the actual complaints process and the kinds of cases, you know, I've been with the board about 2.5 years, and Larry has been involved with the board for, I think, over 10 now. So very briefly, the reason I have this, can we kind of pull together this bar chart for you, is that it shows you a couple of really important basic data pieces. One is basically you have a compilation of 4 fiscal years worth of data on this chart, and it shows you that while we have had, out of the last 4 fiscal years, 2 that had a peak at around 73, 74 complaints coming in, others lower, on average, what it shows you, and it's really important for planning purposes to not go by one-time peaks, but on averages, it shows you that on average, we take in at least 60 complaints a year, if you average that out over the 4 years. The other piece that I, quite frankly, insisted when I got in the door that we start doing is that we counterplay that we basically set that against what it is we're actually able to accomplish all the way through the completion process. So not just an investigation report, but an actual case closure by the board, an actual finished settlement, or a final order. And if you look at the 10-year average of what we've been able to accomplish, usually on a 10-year basis, we can say that it takes one investigator, when we still had one investigator and contract investigators, that we were able to finish about 31 cases a year on average. What does that tell you? Something very important. It means that on a recurring basis, when we had one investigator and contract investigators, our ability to resolve was about half the current average that we have. And that, quite frankly, from a data perspective, is the reason why we're asking for a recurring, ongoing addition of a second investigator in policy package 100, and Larry will get a little bit more into detail on this. There's one other really important takeaway from this chart that I would like you to see, and this is a little bit more in the category of trying to demonstrate of, we got a lot of wonderful help from this panel and DAS last session by allowing us to add in, essentially at the legislative phase, this limited duration second investigator position, a position that was hired in September 2013. And What I'm trying to get is that at the resolution level, okay, we have been able to now start. We see the first increase in the last biennium, in the last fiscal year where we actually had that position. We see the first increase in the resolution rate up to 46. What you don't have on here is calendar year data that I'm happy to share with you, because it's a little bit more recent. If you look at exactly that same 12-month performance of 46, the increase from the 31 average to 46. And if I had the calendar year up here of 2014, it would show you another climb up to 51. What does that tell you? It tells you that the addition of the resource of the second investigator is beginning to show the impact in terms of our ability to resolve cases. And so that is another piece where I think the committee really needs to know that as part of considering the policy packages for the board. With that, I will stop where I'm at and let Larry get on with his introduction and more in-depth presentation on the challenge of our complaint caseload.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Whitten.
Thank you. In looking at the little more deeply into your budget, the DAS charges, your DAS service charges seem to be astronomical for this agency. You've gone from $154,000 in the last biennium to $240,825 for the next biennium. It's an 84% increase. And I also understand that that rate increase has been colored so that there's another $60,000 that's been delayed until the next biennium. So now we're talking in the 17-19, correct me if I'm wrong, but the DAS service, you know, the fixed fees and the fee for services altogether will be about $344,000 in the next biennium, which is $43,000 per FTE. So I don't know whether the director can explain it or not, but I think DAS should explain. That's, Mr. Chair, more than a minimum wage job for DAS services.
Yeah.
That's a great observation.
Interesting question. It should be helpful if you get the answer on that. Thank you for pointing that out, Senator.
So I don't know if you want me to answer that or not. I know it's mostly DAS question.
I would like you just to confirm those figures.
Okay. So Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, I think the numbers were very accurate. The number that I have is $154,000, $815 that was provided for DAS for this biennium as compared to $284,363 equivalent number for next biennium. That was still during the administrative during the request phase of the budget that may have shifted a little bit during the governor's phase. So I don't know exactly where those stand, but it should be very close to what's there now. And that I also want to confirm on the record that I was also told that that includes a $60,000 holdback. So you're accurate that or delay or whatever term you want to attach to that to the 17-19 biennium. So it is true that we are, I can confirm at least factually, that we are on the receiving end of some very significant increases in that portion of our budget, which drives back to the beginning of my presentation of that's one key reason, probably the primary reason, why the CSL budget for this agency for 15-17 with 7 employees is almost at the same level as the legislatively approved budget for the current biennium with 8.
Thank you.
Senator, we're going to do some homework on that. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah.
Let's continue.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Smith. Co-Chair, I always struggle with Senator Steiner Hayward.
Don't worry about it. He's chair, and you can just pay attention to him.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And the rest of the committee, first of all, let me introduce myself. I'm Larry Brown. As Martin said, I am the chair of the Board of Accountancy starting January 1 of this year. I've been in the accounting profession for just over 40 years, a CPA for 37 of those years. In addition to that, I actually was an adjunct accounting professor at Oregon State for about 8 or 9 years. Mm-hmm. For fun, which it was a lot of fun. I have been on the complaints committee. I served on the complaints committee of the board for 6 years from 2005 through 2010. Spent a couple of years off of any official role, but actually helped with some investigations and then came on the board. So as Martin said, I've been involved with the complaints process very closely for over a decade. I'm going to be able to go through some of these slides because we've talked about some of my speaking points already, but this slide is actually in response to to Co-Chair Smith's question, what are the types of complaints we've heard? And as I indicated, they range the gamut from administrative in nature all the way to what I would consider pretty egregious acts of ethical behavior or misbehavior.
Very quickly before you proceed, I really apologize. I got out front of you.
Oh, no, that's quite all right.
I see that you're addressing that right
and
now.
And I would welcome questions. I'd much rather respond to questions and just go through some slides. So please ask any questions, and I think it's more lively. But again, I mean, issues with ethical professional misconduct, they tend to be more difficult, take more time to investigate, and quite honestly, the individual tends to fight them harder because it's a lot easier to say that, yeah, I didn't understand the tax code correctly versus saying, hey, I, you know, acted inappropriately. So not only has the caseload, in my view, increased over time, the complexity, the nature and complexity of the cases have increased. So what do we... Martin, please. Yep. What have we done with the, with respect to that? What's our response been? Well, we did, as Martin indicated, we did add the second limited duration investigator, starting September 13. That was very effective. And in our 15-17 policy option package, we are requesting the continuation of that position. As Martin indicated, you know, we historically been able to resolve about 30, a little over 30 cases per year with one. We'll never catch up, never get ahead of where we need to be, you know, with just one. So that second position is vital, you know, in order to, I hate it when we say in order to meet our measurement goals, our KPMs, but more importantly, to be able to serve, you know, our constituents appropriately and get things resolved, get them behind them, get the, you know, public protection measures in place. We also had to resort to increased, and I'll say judicious, use of contract investigators. We're very careful of who we use a contract investigator for to make sure it was the most efficient use of our resources. Typically, the contract investigators would be used in areas where there was a technical issue, and we felt that there was, you know, better technical resources to investigate other than people on our staff. We have some great people on our staff, but, you know, in our profession, there's some technical issues that, you know, is better matched up that way. So we have increased the use of contract investigators. Last fall, the e-board did graciously approve us increasing our professional services line item for that purpose. And we also included in the policy option package this year $75,000 additional specifically for the use of contract investigators. That doesn't seem like it adds a lot, but, you know, 4 hours a week over the two-year period, but used appropriately, used judiciously, it does add a significant ability for us to get cases resolved. To me, one of the most important things is process improvements. We have, over the past 6-8 months, as we really have been focused on budgetary issues now and in the future, et cetera, really trying to review our processes and match up the protection of public with the process. You know, there's some of those complaints that we talked about were more administrative in nature. The process for resolving, investigating, and resolving those is not necessarily the same as an individual that displayed questionable ethical behavior. And we're really looking closely, and we've already implemented some changes so that we can be more efficient and be more appropriate in our matching of resources, dollars, with protecting the public. You know, what really is protecting the public? And matching that up so that I can look anybody in the eye and say, I think we are being as efficient as we can. This includes, as that last bullet points out, this coming May, we're going to devote a significant portion of our public work session discussing and entertaining recommendations as to how we can even be more efficient. Our other budget challenges is actually, as Senator Witsit just summarize for us. So, I mean, this is the same thing. You know, we are looking at a very significant increase of the state government service charge coming from DAS. The numbers have already been summarized, so I'm not going to waste your time reading through those. But, you know, that is a concern. And what has happened in the current year, and this goes back to your question, Co-Chair Smith, about the ending balance, we've seen that go down. I go back far enough on the board and committee. We used to be concerned that we're building too much of a fund balance and how can we, you know, reduce fees, et cetera. Because of a couple of events this year, mostly which we had a very significant contested case issue relating to professional misconduct, ethical behavior, we had to spend a very significant amount of resources on that matter. That coupled with some other less expensive things has caused our carryover balance, our fund balance, to drop significantly. Again, it's a little misleading, though, to focus on that, you know, $1.4 million or even the 200, because it's close to the top of our bubble. It's, you know, we have to use that to operate on for a period of time. So,
I got a question here, Senator Whitson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Brown, the slide shows an increase of $23,828 for the Department of Justice expenses. That's just the increase. What are your Department of Justice expenses?
Off the top of, Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitson, members of the committee, off the top of my head, the current biennium base for DOJ was about $161,328. That was increased by $100,000 by e-board action in September to exactly $100,000 more. So it's 268 something because of that very, very significant contested case. Our actual for this biennium will actually be even higher. I think we're probably going to end up at about $300,000 for DOJ for this biennium. However, I want to be really clear that what you're looking at is not built on these kind of one-time factors. So the way the DOJ line item was built for 15-17 was to revert back to the base of the original 161, add I think a certain inflationary amount. And then you add in this, if you then add in that policy package request, that $23,000 number that you have on your screen, I believe that the number that we arrived at in terms of the total proposed for DOJ, and again, I'm pulling this off the top of my head, is about $207,000. That is, I believe, sitting in that line item as the actual proposal. So I think the more accurate from a comparative perspective number would be that if you look at the original base from 13-15, you're looking at about 161 compared to about a $207,000 request, including that policy package up here. I hope that that's a sufficient answer for now for the
so in round numbers, between the Department of Justice and DAS, you're getting hit for $500,000.
Co-Chair Smith, Senator Whitsett, yes, sir.
Thank you.
So my final prepared comments would just be a summary.
Let's head back really quick.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Let's head back to the last slide. I really want to understand the ending balance again. So I'm assuming there's a set-aside for extraordinary circumstances. No?
Not directly.
Okay.
If I may just, historically, we were always, when I say always, it's been many years, we've been operating with a, lack of a better term, a generous ending balance.
Okay, so
we always identified that if we had a major issue, we could easily use $500,000, just as an example, and not that we ever have anything like that, but the state of Texas, in the follow-up on the Enron matters, it was millions of dollars.
So then with a projected ending balance of $986,000, is that good for a quarter? Is that good for 6 months? based upon your operating, you know, your monthly operating needs, how long does that last you?
Well, Co-Chair Smith, our annual budget for this past year, we'll say, was roughly 2.2, so just under $200,000 a quarter. So one way of looking at that, or $200,000 a month, excuse me, that would be $1 million would be just under 5 months. It's a little bit distorted because we'll still have some revenue coming in June, et cetera, but it certainly, in my view, is not an imprudent number high, on the high side, if anything, mm-hmm. on the low side.
Let me ask one more question just so I understand it. And I thoroughly agree with what you're saying there. Mm-hmm. What would help us understand a worst-case scenario of an extraordinary situation? What could it potentially cost your agency?
I'm just being blunt, Co-Chair Smith. Probably a worst-case scenario is a major accounting firm that has very deep pockets, very deep resources, and I'm an alumni of one of those. So,
sure.
It gets embroiled in a very messy accounting tax issue with a major company.
And so at all that point, you're coming back to us to go to the emergency board for the resources.
I don't want to jinx this by even, you know, saying
right,
this,
I understand.
But you could be looking at several million dollars. I mean, I guess, you know, I hope to heck that we don't ever face that. But, you know, you would be looking at people with very deep resources and a very strong endeavor to keep the record clean, if you will. So yes, if we had to, we would need to come back to you in order to protect the integrity of the whole process.
Okay.
Co-Chair Smith, just to make sure that I put this very clearly on the record, based on the original question that you had, there is no other set-aside fund. So in essence, one of the things I always emphasize for any regulatory board, and it's true for this one too, the ending balance serves two purposes. Mm-hmm. One is cash flow, which is important for us because we, as you already helped us point out, we don't have a regular cash flow.
Right.
We're annualized, basically. Second, it's a public protection function because that is the kitty bank that, as we had to last September, we go to the e-board for and saying, would you please allow us to dip into that portion of our ending balance and increase our expenditure limit? But there is no other fund out there.
So I just want to play on that one last. Your next point there towards the bottom, in the proposed 15-17 governor's budget, mm-hmm. they're assuming an additional $662,000 of ending fund balance because they're assuming you're not going to have extraordinary cases, or are they assuming there's going to be an increase in revenue? It's one of the two. There's either more revenue or less expense.
Well, that assumption moves the fund balance down from the 986 to by 662, so that would leave us a fund balance of $300,000.
Oh, I understand what you're saying now.
Yeah.
Well, that's not good.
It uses that fund balance, and so based on that budget, we would be less than $400,000 at the at June 30th of 2017.
Okay. Well, that sure would leave you vulnerable, yeah. Wouldn't it?
And Co-Chair Smith and members of the committee, that's what we get into in the next slide. I mean, basically what we're just doing is set up the last part of the discussion that Larry will have as to why it is that you're also faced with something else that's not formally before this committee now. My understanding from Kim Toe is that it just arrived in Ways and Means, I believe, yesterday, is Senate Bill 581-A, which we've been working on together, and I'll let Larry describe that on the next slide.
So thank you, Martin, Co-Chair Smith. Hopefully not surprising to the committee that if there's looming budgetary issues, that it would be a group of accountants that would address them sooner than perhaps other groups. So we actually, as the board and staff recognized, we had a looming issue quite a while ago. We work very closely for 8 months, 6 to 8 months, with the Oregon Society of CPAs as well as the OAI, Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. And, you know, hand in hand, had a joint task force working together with coming up to a satisfactory resolution that we all could agree with. the board probably would have liked a little bit more. OSCP would have liked a little bit less. But all at the end of the day, we're all in complete agreement that we need to have an increase in fees, and that's Senate Bill 581A, proposed increase in fees. It's being it's requested and managed, sponsored by the OSCPA. But again, it's with their support that we're anticipating or hoping for the approval of the increase in fees to cover, you know, our increased cost of compliance investigation, and you know, and some, to some extent, the increase in the charges. But
I appreciate it. That bullet point on page 9 now makes tremendous more sense, much more sense to me.
I'm sorry.
I've got to ask a Senator Johnson question. I've been with the Senate so long.
I entered right on cue.
On cue.
We're all channeling you, Senator.
If I remember correctly, it's been 15 years since the last fee increase. Mm-hmm. Why did we wait so long for us to be with our nose hanging over the cliff to address this?
Senator Chair or Senator Smith, we didn't need it. I mean, we were
okay.
We're adequately funded. I think the board has been judicious in their use of money. We did have there hasn't been a significant increase. I think there's a $5 increase somewhere in there, so I just want to make sure the record's clear. And it really wasn't until we had this significant case. We've never, at least in the history that I recall, which goes back a ways, we've never had a case where we have had to spend so much money to get what I consider to be the right outcome. Could have been more even if it would have gone on down the litigation route, although we were able to settle it. So the short answer is, until that used up a lot of our fund balance, coupled with just some other general increases, we realized that we were getting close to needing a fee increase, and then coupled with the matters that Senator Whitsitt pointed out, you know, exacerbated that a little bit.
Madam Co-Chair.
I think Mr. Pignani wants to just respond for them. That's fine with me if he goes ahead.
Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, just for in the interest of full transparency and clarity, I just want to put on the record, when we talk about we haven't had a fee increase in 15 years, we're talking with focus on 581 and the primary, like as in major primary revenue driver for the board, which is the individual renewal fee. There are, as with any regulatory board, a smattering of other fees. Some of them are sitting in statute, some of them are sitting in rule. There have been some fee increases in those, but the reality is that where it really matters is the individual renewal fee. That's really the primary revenue driver, and that one has in fact sat largely untouched since 2000. I think there was a $10 increase in Senate Bill 867 in the 2009 session.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. One of the questions that I've had for a while now is we get these fee increase bills through, and believe me, I support this one. Let me start by saying that, because you guys have done everything right about this. You haven't asked for one inappropriately. You've got the entire professional society on board. Nothing that one could ask more.
Thank you.
That being said, I've often wondered why we don't index registration fees, which is to say a lot of things, like the minimum wage in Oregon is indexed to the CPI, and so minimum wage goes up every year based on the CPI. And, you know, we see those increases in our budgets, and I've often felt pretty strongly that, I mean, I'm licensed by a professional board too, and I wouldn't mind it if my registration fee went up, because it would mean that taxpayers weren't picking up an ever-increasing portion of the work of the agency that licenses my profession. I'm cautious about using taxpayer dollars to subsidize professional licenses, to be honest. Subsidizing the investigation side of it makes a certain amount of sense, although I know that I think we should contribute to investigation costs too, because that keeps our professions clean and honorable and with good practice standards. But I'm just wondering whether you guys talked about indexing at all, which was a very long question for not a very long-winded question for a fairly short answer.
Co-Chair Smith and Co-Chair Hayward, short answer is we actually have talked about it. But I also will be honest with you, this is not as a response from my current position with my current board, but much more from a perspective of, this is, I think, at least the fourth regulatory board I've had the privilege to serve for as a director. Mm-hmm. This is a cross, as you recognize, profession challenge. And quite frankly, I think one of the reasons where even those that have thought about it would shy away from it, and I'm not saying that it's a bad idea, but I think there are some real hurdles that you're dealing with. One is there's a certain amount of efficiency that you gain by not constantly changing the fees that you're dealing with. Okay, so there's a certain amount of resistance to this year the fees that you have a constant amount of change. Mm-hmm. That also, quite frankly, is difficult for any, regardless of the reason, regardless of whether it's indexing or other drivers that may, you know, there, it's difficult, particularly in smaller boards in the professions, to deal with constant changes in the fee levels. I'll be honest about that. That's just there's a little bit of a, sure, kind of a resistance, if you will, built into the process. Having said that, I'll give you a completely opposite perspective. There is, quite frankly, nothing that some would love more than we feel caught between you, by definition, you have, by definition, flat fees against indexed increases that are coming from everywhere. So it puts you in a little bit of a difficult position, one way or the other.
Thank you. Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I get what you're saying about annual changes. A lot of boards do what you do, which is provide a two-year license. I don't know if you do all of yours at once, or whether some of them, if it's like half do 1 year and half do the other. Mm-hmm. But there, I mean, I'm doing it every year may not make sense. But what if you did it every 4 years? You know, what if you put it in? And I do think that if we started to approach this thing, obviously doing it in this bill, it doesn't make any sense. This thing's locked and loaded, and I don't want to go messing with it in Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. It's a bad idea. but I think we should do it across the board if we're going to do it, because I do have concerns about the taxpayers continuing to subsidize what are essentially business costs. For as a cost of doing business. I mean, your professional license is a cost of doing business, and the state subsidizing some of it, in essence, is reasonable. The state subsidizing an ever-increasing percentage, as it's been doing since 2000, since you haven't raised it up, you know, in terms of your operating budget, that's why I'm concerned. Well, you guys are mostly fee-based, aren't you? So there isn't, mm-hmm, really, yeah, sorry, mm-hmm, about that. That was wrong. I blew that one. Every now and then I do that too. but regardless, I just think it's important because you do have the struggle with ending fund balance and stuff, mm-hmm, like that. So,
I'm going to ask you folks, just take 3 minutes and wrap up this slide, and then we're going to continue on.
Well, this slide, quickly, as I said, we have the complete support of all of our constituents in the profession. The fee increase that's concluded in Senate Bill 581A is, as indicated there, an increase from 160 to 255 for the individual licenses, and then a similar increase for firms. Incidentally, Co-Chair Senator Hayward, those numbers would not be too much different than if you would have inflation adjusted going back 15 years. I did that. I mean, they're not exact, but it'd be a lot less of a spread. So I appreciate that comment and observation. These fees are set in statute, so, you know, that presents a problem of, you know.
You can index things in statute. That's what we do with the minimum. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but anyway, you can index things in statute. Right. You start at a certain point, you index it, and that's how we do it.
And we'll be implementing the fee, assuming they're approved. We'll be implementing the fees at the most, you know, current, the soonest reasonable cycle of doing so, so that we can protect our fund balance to the extent necessary.
Any questions? Director or Chair. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're up.
Okay.
I cut you off. I apologize.
Oh, sorry.
Sir.
Let me
I was just going to thank you all for your service.
Shut this down, and then do you know where you are?
Yeah, over here.
Over here.
one?
Oh, perfect. I want to make sure we have time for the public testimony.
From where? From whom?
They're coming, I'm sure of it. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Mark Wiedema, and I'm the analyst, CFO analyst for the Board of Accountancy. And I will try and address, too, some of the questions that have been raised and... There we go. Okay. So in the governor's budget, the proposal is to maintain the current level of operations. And the revenue projections that were used in the budget were the current statutory rates. And on the outcome area, the Board of Accountancy is in the public safety area there. And then to address here again, you can see the actual expenditures in 2011-13 of $1.8 million. And then the increase last biennium with the limited duration position, and then the continuation of that position. So the increase for this biennium, the current LAV is the 2.3, and the governor's proposal is 2.5. And then one of the things that we were talking about here also was the revenues and the ending fund balance. And as you can see, the blue area there at the bottom with the fees fixed, you can see the ending balance continued to grow from 2005 up through the 11-13 biennium. And it's really been, you know, kind of now that we're seeing it decline kind of after that 11-13, basically the same in the 13-15. But that is a projected ending balance. Mm-hmm. And you'll also notice that the revenue in the current governor's budget are closer to the actual, and we're not, you know, shooting off of budgeted. And also I'd point out that 94% of the agency's revenue is from CPAs and CPA firms. And CPAs pay a biannual rate on a odd even annual basis, so those of us who have a even number certificate pay in even numbered years, and then firms pay on a calendar year basis. And then finally, the governor supported package 100, the continuation of the investigator, and the increase in the professional services and the attorney general fees. And also, in terms of the DAS charges, I've been working with the folks over at DAS, and it's the assessments have stayed quite flat. The increases have been in those components of services where it's the fee-for-service component, that there are a group of agencies on the customer utility boards who are setting those fees for service, and I know that, you know, this body will also look at those fees as part of the DAS budget. And, you know, if those get adjusted down, then those changes would also be reflected through agency budgets. And as also pointed out, the governor's budget did not assume a fee increase. But at the same point in time, we knew that the agency was working with their stakeholders. And the governor's office has supported that fee increase bill. The board was able to work out with the Oregon Society and other stakeholders. With that, that is the end of my proposal. If anybody has any questions.
Perfect. Any questions? Any comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Public testimony time. Rob, come on down. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, here today representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. It's been my pleasure to represent the CPA since 1978. It's been a very good relationship. I submitted some written testimony, which I believe the members have. I just want to be loving, caring, supportive. We do support this budget, and I do want to just re-stress to the committee that Senate Bill 581, which is a significant increase in fees for individuals and firms, was introduced at the request of the Oregon State Society of Certified Public Accountants. There's a lot of discussion about whether fees should be in statute or agencies should have the ability to just adopt them by administrative rule after public hearing. One thing I would say is that the fact that the fee is in statute means that only you can change it. That forces the parties to do a lot of very good work prior to the Legislative Assembly to actually go through these budgets, go through these fees, look at expenditures, look at outcomes, and that was done in this case. Perfect. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you. Mr. Douglas, do you think the accountants would be willing to go ahead with that fee increase if those accountants knew that, that virtually half of the increase was due to service government service charge increases?
Co-chairs, Senator Whitsitt, I was not present, but there were a number of CPAs that worked with the Board of Accountancy going through the budget line by line, and that was discussed. So that did factor into the decision.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else here, which is a good sign. We like that.
Full of extensive public testimony on our bills.
Yes. All right. I do want to give a chance, though, if anyone wants to share any other thoughts or has any other questions.
I'm assuming that the co-chairs are going to be looking at these service charges.
We're going to take a look at that,
yeah.
Most definitely.
We will be having conversations about them.
I would wonder if this isn't more systemic than just in the Board of Accountancy.
We will ask that question.
We will ask that question.
That was a good catch.
It was.
All righty. Anything else we need to be thinking about? Nope. Nope. Julie, we're good? All right, we're going to adjourn for the day.
You're 25 minutes ahead.